Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Peter Mathis.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Agnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Stone from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And as usual, we've got a couple of topics to discuss from the world of sport. And we have one special guest, and that is the hockey umpire Murray Grime, who hung up his whistle at the end of 2016. I think he would have liked to have kept going, but the age restrictions on international umpires meant that he had to stop officiating, but he's still very much involved in the game, which is great because you do not want to lose that experience. Anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And I believe, John, I'm starting us off this time.
Yep, your turn to kick it off.
Okay, well, I'm going back to a topic that you actually raised, I think it was about three podcasts ago, about the stoush, I suppose it is, between the AOC and the Australian Sports Commission, which is the AOC being the Australian Olympic Committee, and John Coates. Now, to me, it was great news to hear in the last week that John Coates is going to have a challenger for his position at the head of the AOC for the first time in 27 years. That's for his role as president, and that's coming from Hockey Roo's gold medalist Danny Roach. Now, the thing I liked about her when she came forward, and there's two things I want to talk about here, was first of all, she said she was prepared to, and we know that she's in a position where she can say this because of her family business is a very, very big business and she's very wealthy from that. But she said, I do not need the salary. I will work for nothing. I will give the $750,000 a year back to the athletes. Now, I thought that was fantastic. But it also, to me, it raised the issue here is, are we paying the CEOs in sport too much money? And should they be putting more back into it? Because you've said to me off air many times that administrators in sport have got to realise that the only reason they are there is because of the athletes on the pitch or on the track or and whatever. So they've got to realise that if those athletes weren't down there doing their stuff, then they wouldn't have a job. And I'm just going to look at some of the salaries just to give you a rough idea. And it's quite hard to kind of find some of the exact salaries. But if you look at the head of the AFL at the moment, Gillon McLachlan.
It's no surprise you don't know that.
I know. I don't follow that. You remember what the show's called. But he's on $1.7 million a year, whereas the highest player in that sport is apparently on $270,000 a year. So there's a big difference there. If we look at John O'Neill when he was at Football Australia, he was on $1.2 million. Ben Buckley, $1.3 million. So you're getting the picture. So we're seeing these guys earning a lot more. And again, the median salary within the A-League is just over $100,000.
Just a correction there on your highest for the AFL per season. That would be an average.
Yeah, the average salary is I thought I said median.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, the highest paid player. There might be two or three blokes that maybe crack a million.
Yeah, but I thought I'd said median price. But what I'm getting at is there's still a massive difference between what the top administrators are getting and what the actual athletes are getting. Now, is that right? Should we be seeing more people looking to do what Danny Roach is suggesting, where they sacrifice some of that salary, even if they put it into junior development? What a difference that could make. I mean, certainly in sports like football, I know it would be a huge thing. I'm talking soccer here. If they had $750,000 went into junior development, the game would be in a much better position than it currently is now. I also then looked up what the sort of average salaries were for CEOs. Now, this comes from sportspeople.com, and they were saying what the average salary should be for people in those positions. And they did them on a basis of national, international as well, and what they should be on a state and territory basis. Now, they were saying that the median price, and okay, this isn't the head of it nationally, but $92,000 is the, and I know that a lot of state CEOs in sporting organisations here in Western Australia are on a lot more than $92,000. It was saying that national bodies should be around about the $112,000 is the median. So again, an international. So if you look at that, state and territories, it's still saying around about 103,922. But we have CEOs on around about 160 upwards in many of the local sports. And again, you have to say, is that too much? And there is again the issue of how much influence the board has and whether they put too much influence and don't let the CEOs actually do what they're paid to do. But I think it was really interesting what Danny Roach said. I applaud her for that, and I would like to see that area of the game reviewed. I just want to move on to the one other point that I have, John, and it was very interesting because when it was announced that she was going to stand for the presidency of the AOC, Mike Tancred, who is the AOC chief media chief, he came out in strong, like, defence that I've never seen for somebody in that organisation. He goes, detractors know very little about sport and don't qualify to carry his bag in regards to John Coates. He then went on to say, what was it? I was just trying to find it here. He said he's not going to be pushed aside by someone who wants to suddenly say to him, oh, your days are up, mate. See you later. Go. Now, is this the right approach for a media officer of an organisation where somebody is elected to that position? To me, I don't think they should be making those statements. That is not their job to make those statements. But then to carry it a step further, the thing that was terrifying for me was Mike Tancred was given then a column in The Australian to defend John Coates. Now, what entitles him as the chief media officer to actually be given that soapbox to promote his boss? Now, to me, that just smells really, really bad.
That should disqualify him automatically and immediately from that position. Absolutely, automatically. You're out the door, mate. You cannot be seen to be interfering with what goes on at that level of the organisation. That is directly interfering, and his position is untenable. Goodbye. And if I ever read anything written by him, I know it's complete bollocks.
Well, I mean, I don't know how the editor at The Australian could even have allowed that to ever go to print or go online, because, as you say, it's biased, it is inappropriate, if you want my opinion.
Oh, it's worse than inappropriate. Yeah,
it just shouldn't happen.
Absolutely, it shouldn't happen. And that's the sort of thing that people like ASIC should be looking at.
Yeah, I mean, well, the one thing that is clear is, of course, if Danny Roach does get in, I think Mike Tancred is going to be out the door straight away.
Well, what was that quote about John Coates not wanting people to tell him your time's up and to get out?
So this is what Mike Tancred said to the media to defending his boss. He said he's not just going to be pushed aside by someone who wants to suddenly say to him, oh, your days are up, mate. See you later. Go.
How many times do you reckon John Coates has used those words to people? How many people out there that have been part of the Australian sporting landscape have heard that said to them? And guess what? It happens to all of us at some stage, John, especially when you've been in the job for 30 years. And let's have a look at the Australian Olympic Committee's record over those 30 years. Where do they actually stand? What has John Coates brought to the Australian sporting landscape?
Well, it's interesting.
Don't
because
say the 2000 Olympics either, because that wasn't just him.
No, there were a lot of people involved
Absolutely.
In that.
Absolutely.
But the other thing that is interesting is in this column in the Australian, he goes, Coates has actually been looking for a successor for several years, but has not found the right person. He hopes his successor will come from the next executive board, which is also elected on May the 6th.
The arrogance!
Now, is that the job of the president, to find the next successor?
It is not. It is absolutely not his job, and it's not something he should be even involved in. It's staggering, the arrogance of that, honestly. And that shows exactly why he's got to leave the position. Now, just quickly, what does the AOC do? Does it provide funding to athletes?
No, it does get some funding, but it's mainly to help them pay. It gets money from the government and raises money for them to go and attend Olympic Games.
Okay, so it pays travel costs to Olympic Games, but it does nothing to develop or support athletes, does it?
No.
Okay. Does it run any coaching clinics?
I'm not sure on that one.
Okay, I'm just trying to figure out what it does for sport. And so far, all I can figure out is that it arranges airfares and accommodations at a sporting event every 4 years.
Well, the other thing that I think that I don't agree with, and I would like to see all these Olympic committees go around the world, because I think it is wrong, is, as we've discussed before, once an Olympic team is announced or an athlete qualifies for an Olympics and is selected, they then take over the management of that athlete and that team up until and after the Olympic Games. Now, to me, that is horribly, horribly wrong, because what you've seen in New Zealand, and we've seen it in South Africa, and it's going to be very interesting because there's a young athlete, a fencer in South Africa, who is taking the South African Olympic Committee to court because she qualified through the international qualification process, but they opted not to take her to Rio. And she's going, what gives them the power to do that? I've met the criteria approved by the IOC and by the international body that I compete under. So what gives this body suddenly the power to prevent me fulfilling my dream? And I don't agree with these Olympic committees. I think they should be chucked in the bin, and we should just let the sports that run their sport decide the qualification process. They approve who goes, and those sports manage those teams to the Olympics and when they compete at the Olympics.
One of the things that's really struck me has been the response to Danny's position, or decision to stand for that position. Now, we've seen a couple of big heavy hitters come out in support of John Coates. We've seen the Australian, obviously, with their decision to print the interview the article you previously mentioned. But we've also seen people like Graham Richardson, the former Labor minister, a former minister of sport, as it turned out, and at one time a printing entrepreneur. And you can find out more about that if you go to the Wikipedia page. Now,
of course, Wikipedia is always reliable.
Well, it is on that particular story. You can find out more there. Now, Graham Richardson came out and said we should back John Coates because he's been there for 30 years and he has all the experiences. She's got no experience, so he's got experience and he should be the one. Now, Graham, that is the last death cry of the faltering incumbent politician. I've been doing it. I know what I'm doing. They don't know what they're doing. Leave me in the job. Because you've got nothing else to say. He's got nothing else to say. Nothing else that he can say to back up why John Coates should stay in that position, except that he's been in that position for a long time. Following on Graham's logic, no one would ever get a job anywhere. No one would ever go past the position they currently hold because they've never done it before. And that's what Graham Richardson's saying, is that we've got to stick with him because everybody else is too stupid to do it. And that's just rubbish. It's just complete rubbish, and he should know better. It is what politicians say when they know the young up and coming star is going to take away all the privileges that they've had for, in this case, the last 30 years.
But I think as well, John, you have to just simply, we know, having been on air, or well, I think it's now 12 or 13 years, 2005, so 12 years was when we first launched Not the Footy Show. And if you've seen the changes in sport that we've seen, sport changes rapidly these days.
Absolutely.
So if you go back 30 years and how sport was then, and let's be honest, so 30 years ago, we're going back to, what's that, 1987. Yeah, the Olympic Games had only just become professional around that time.
Well, the athletes.
I mean, officially allowed to earn money, whereas before it was...
Officially, officials were earning a lot of money out of the Olympic Games.
Oh, well, we know that. But what I'm saying is it's evolved so much. If you're at the top of it, you have to evolve with it. And I question the ability of the incumbent at the moment whether he has evolved with the sport at the rate at which the sport has evolved. And I'm not sure that he has, and I think he's past his use-by date, and I certainly think he should take his spokesperson with him when he leaves the AOC.
Well, the worst thing about this is John Coates has a great, what's the word for it, you know, CV when it comes to the work he's done with the AOC and the IOC. You know, that's the hard thing about making criticisms of people that have actually done, at some time, a good job. Now, when he joined the IOC, or when he first became the sort of head of, and in public's perception, the man, our Olympic man, so to speak, the Olympic Games was as corrupt as buggery. I mean, it was a dirty cesspool. Now, he's been part of that transformation to take it from that and to try and clean up the sport. And so we've got to give him a lot of respect for the work he has done at times. But that time has now passed. As you say, it's time for fresh blood. But and there like, should be a position yeah. that is, quote, there's got, you know, two terms or three terms. You shouldn't be allowed to stay there for as long as you want.
I agree with that in every level of administration. I don't think you should be. If you look at, they say in business that the ideal time for a CEO is 7 to 8 years because you can implement things, put them forward, implement them, and then you move on and let the next person carry it to the next level in their tenure. And so I do agree with that. I think that two terms, and that's why if you look at most board terms, are 3-year periods or 4 years is very rare. Usually it's 2 to 3 year terms on any board. And it's for that same reason, because if you serve two terms, you're there for 6 years, it gives you the chance to put forward things, see them implemented, move on and let the next fresh breath of air come in. And I just think, yes, John Coates has done a lot of good. We cannot ever deny that, but his time has come, just as it comes to everybody in the end.
The one that's crept under the radar, though, when we originally brought this up, John Wiley, the Australian Sports Commission. And that's a place that I think needs a broom through it, because when administrators become more important than sports people, then we've got the whole thing the wrong way around.
That goes back to the point I made at the very beginning, that these administrators are only there because of the athletes. And the emphasis should be on the athletes, not on the administrators. And I'm sorry, but I think the administrators are getting paid way too much.
And let's face it, that idea goes all the way back through to the most amateur of amateur sports. That it's the sports person, it's the athlete that's out on the field or on the court or whatever they're on, that makes that position possible, the administrative position. And at those levels, people work very diligently and hard and long hours for no money at all. And without them doing that, the big fat cats at the top ain't got nothing.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe, and you're listening to Not The Footy Show.
Well, yes, we mentioned we have one guest on the show, and it's now time to turn our attention to our guest, and that is Murray Grime, the international hockey umpire. He is one of only 5 umpires in the international game to have umpired over 200 games, which is quite an achievement. And so I caught up with Murray Grime over a coffee to look back on his career and what he's going to do in the future. Murray Grime, welcome to Not The Footy Show.
Oh, thanks, Ashley. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to catch up with you, because I'm thinking last year must have been a really emotional year in that you became the 5th hockey umpire to officiate in over 200 games, but then you had to retire not long after.
Yeah, look, it's been a long and illustrious career, over 23 years umpiring international hockey. Yeah, look, it was very sad for myself in Melbourne. It's one of those things that, you know, they bring a retirement age in, whether it's the right thing or the wrong thing for them to do, but that's the draw, unfortunately.
It must have been really tough, as you say, 23 years is a long time. How did you get into umpiring in the first place?
Look, I started playing at a reasonably young age, played state junior hockey, and then had a couple of injuries to my knees, and thought about retiring from hockey, and someone said, why don't you give umpiring a go for 12 months? And I took that option up and progressed pretty quickly through the system, and I think it took 3 years I got into the international scene.
Yeah, I saw that. I mean, you were with the FAH World Panel in 99, having started in 94. Was that quicker than even you expected?
Yeah, I think it was, but they were at the sort of stage where they had a lot of older guys on the international scene, and they were looking for a younger group to come through, and, you know, I was at the right place at the right time and took me opportunities.
How difficult was it being a young umpire? You know, obviously, and at that stage, umpiring guys that may have been older than you.
Oh, look, it's one of those transition stages. You know, you all go out there with a cocky approach, I guess. You want to go out there and prove something to say that, you know, you are good at what you do. But, you know, it's one of those things you never stop to learn. And, you know, you look at the older people that are umpiring those days, and you always take bits and pieces of how they umpired. You know, they're good at management or decision making. So you sort of mould yourself into your own person.
What do you think is one of the keys? Is it communication with the players?
I think communication, the way you manage the game, if you can have your players in your hand, you don't want to go out there necessarily to give, you know, penalties or suspensions, green cards, yellow cards. I think the days have sort of changed when, you know, it was pretty cut and dry. If someone did something wrong, you sent them off, where now it's a bit more lenient and, you know, it's really important to have those communication skills with the players.
I know certain players have said they reckon, you know, you're a pretty hard umpire out there when they look back on you, but I think they all know not to mess with you as well. I mean, how do you feel about that assessment?
Oh, look, I think it's a pretty good call, actually. I think, you know, I always say I'm hard but fair. Players sort of know what they can get away with certain umpires, especially on the international scene and national competitions. Look, I've always set myself pretty high standards and the players respect that. They can see what they're going to benefit out at the end of the day.
I mean, we saw an article by one of the players recently saying that the umpires don't know the game well enough. Would you agree that that's the case with some, or is that a bit of a harsh criticism?
Oh, look, I think it's a pretty harsh criticism. I think, you know, umpires generally know that what's happening in game and, you know, they know the rules. I think some of the players need to look at themselves and the way they behave. You know, respect and credibility goes both ways. We respect them and they've got to respect us. And unfortunately, at times, frustration comes into it and the players think it's, you know, they're up against a brick wall against the umpires' decisions all the time.
Has there ever been one player you've had real difficult time with?
No, there's been a couple of players, but, you know, over a period of time, I think the way hockey's gone with all these different competitions, the Hockey India League, I think, the you know, it's more of a relaxed mode. We get to know the players a lot better. We can sit down and have breakfast with them at a hotel, where before it was them and us. So I think the mode's actually, you know, it's a far better setting for umpires and players these days.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. I mean, one of the things I remember was the Asia Cup. You made a big call in the last seconds, giving a penalty corner against India, which meant they ended up losing to Korea. I mean, some umpires might have bottled that, deliberately playing it over the baseline, but you were always prepared to make those hard calls.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, the rules are there, and I think, you know, you're a better person, and look, as far as the teams find it and they don't agree with your decision, end of the day you're right, and they knew that you're right. Unfortunately, they didn't go to a World Cup, but you know, you just got to set your standards and you don't change. I've always been one, if you see it you blow it, don't guess.
You went to 4 Olympics, 2 World Cups, I think 6 Champions Trophies, the major tournaments. Are there any moments there that stand out for you?
Oh, look, I think every tournament you go to, you always learn something new, and I think the way hockey's going as far as for general public aspect of viewing, I think the game's changed, it's heading in the right direction. Special moments for me, look, every game is different, but you know, when you reflect back, I reckon there's 2 special games that I ever umpired. One was in Lahore, the Champions Trophy. Pakistan played Germany and they had to win, you know, and you're in front of 70,000 people. All of a sudden you had 15,000 people jump a 6-foot-high fence, and you know, that was a special moment. I suppose maybe 2 other games. One was the World Cup in 2002 where Korea played Germany. That was a really special game of hockey, you know. It was really fast and furious and, you know, exceptional skill level. I guess the other one would have been Germany versus Holland, which always is a great clash. You know, there's 2 games that I can remember. One was at the World Cup in Mönchengladbach in a round game. It was one of the best games of hockey I'd seen. And also, most will be at the Athens Olympics in the semi-final when Germany played Holland.
We hear of what it means for an athlete to go to an Olympic Games. What does it mean for an official to be selected to go?
Oh, look, we always set ourselves goals, and I think you've got to be realistic with where you want to go with umpiring. But, you know, to get appointed to an Olympic Games or a World Cup's really special. You know, I sort of set myself when I was young. You watch TV and you see all these Olympic Games and World Cups happening. You think you really want to be a part of that. It is a special time in your life when you do get appointed and go to them and soak up the atmosphere.
One thing I feel sorry for you about, though, is because your career as an umpire has coincided with Australia being really strong, it's meant you've missed out on umpiring finals in so many tournaments.
Yeah, look, I've been fortunate enough where I've umpired the semi-finals at major events, Olympics and World Cups, and Australia's always played in the other semi-finals. So, you know, in one way you want your country to win, and the other way you think, well, I hope they lose this game, so you get the opportunity, which would have happened. But look, you're there for the game, you're not there for yourself.
No, I'm sure, but it still would have been nice to do a final, wouldn't it?
It would have been. I thought, you know, finishing off in 2016 in Rio, I might have had a pretty good opportunity. Look, I umpired really well. It's mostly at the top of my game, but unfortunately, they decided to give 2 other umpires a crack.
You talked about the rules and players understanding the rules and also maybe viewers and players interpreting the rules. I mean, are there any that you would like to see tweaked or changed that stand out in your mind as an official?
Yeah, look, I think the way they've changed the overhead where you can use your stick, I think that's a good rule now. You just want fast, free-flowing game. I think the only situation that sort of slows the game down now is mostly inside the 23. It's such a critical area where you actually set free hits up and whether you eliminate defenders very quickly with a self-pass. Look, maybe they can be a bit more flexible or sort of change the rule and you know, a bit like ice hockey where they have a little circle, they throw the ball in and that's where they've got to play it from. So, you know, everyone's aware. It just, look, we want to make it attractive sport and for TV audience as well.
You mentioned the overhead, and I feel personally that it should be play on as long as the encroaching isn't deemed dangerous.
Yeah, I think you're right. Look, there's always going to be an aspect of dangerous play, and, you know, we've got a duty of care when we umpire, and the players sort of respect that. Look, players work it out what's going to happen, and the first of the ball, generally you'll find the second and third player will back away and let them bring the ball down safely to the ground.
We've got referrals in the game now, and that's come in recent times, and I think it works in the main really well. Do you like the way it works, and do you think again there is ways to simplify that? I mean, you've been on both ends as an umpire on the pitch and up in the booth.
Yeah, look, I think it's the way all sports are going. I think we do need it, but I think we've sort of just got to modify it to, you know, what decisions we're going to use it for, because I think the teams rely on it too much now, especially in very close towards the end of the games when it's a very tight game, one-all situation. People are just use it. I think we need to sort of steer away from that and maybe give them more opportunities to use it. Instead of just having one referral, maybe have one every half.
No, I think there's a lot of merit to be had for that, certainly from a commentary perspective as well, because sometimes we struggle to work out what they're actually referring. Do you think, again, it should be a case of the umpires just saying, is it a penalty corner or not, rather than we're looking for a foot or we're looking for a backstick?
Yeah, look, that's an interesting point, because the way it's set up at the moment, we can actually go back inside the 23 if we see a breach coming into the circle, where we try and get the teams to ask one question specifically. So I think we need to isolate what actually they're actually looking for. Let's not go back and find previous breaches.
No, I agree with that. Now, I saw when you announced your retirement, you mentioned Ian Pitt as a key man in your career. Can you tell us a little bit about him and his influence?
Yeah, look, Ian, look, he's been around for a long, long time. He played for Australia. He is captain coach of South Australia. This goes back into the late 60s, early 70s. Ian was very instrumental in bringing a lot of umpires' careers, such as Don Pryor and the Alan Shassers, the Craig Beaches, etc. Look, Ian was my first umpires manager in 1987, my first tournament in Canberra. Ever since then, you know, he had the confidence and guided me in the right direction to get me where I ended up. So, you know, you put a lot of time, a lot of effort. Look, Ian was one of these guys, it was never just positive things. He was always very critical, but in being critical, he wanted to make you better. So you always learn the lessons.
Was he someone you could go back to during your career as well for tips?
Yeah, look, Ian used to always come and watch me, even when I was umpiring the Olympic Games, you know, warm-ups, he'd always come out and offer advice. And it's one of those people, he had the credibility, and whatever he said to you, he took it on board. And it might only have been a minor thing, but he wanted you to be better.
How have you taken retirement now? Is it sunk in?
Look, it's slowly sunk in, but what a relief in one way. I can concentrate on my own work. Look, I sacrifice a lot of time to hockey. I do it because I love it. At the moment, I'm actually putting things back into Asian hockey. As far as development programs in Singapore, Bangladesh to a certain degree, Malaysia want to come on board. So, look, I'm trying to do a lot of work with the Asian countries, because I think, you know, they've got a lot of potential, as well as the Australian umpires as well.
So obviously still involved. I mean, is there a place for you in the video booth to actually be a video umpire now that you're no longer allowed to be on the pitch?
Oh, look, you'd always love to go to a national hockey tournament. I've decided to go down the umpire managing role. FIH made a decision that they don't want you to be an umpire's manager or video umpire. So, look, I've elected to go down the umpire managing role. I play that role quite well. I think I've got a lot of knowledge to pass along and also be a mentor to local umpires and Australian-based umpires.
Well, that's really good. Now, just before we let you go, obviously the FIH is going through a revolution, as they call it. I mean, there seems to be a lot of things changing, including the World League. I mean, how do you feel the future looks for hockey?
Oh, look, I think the future, I think we've got to be realistic. I think the game will change. I think, you know, they're set in stone at Tokyo Olympics, it's going to be 11-a-side. But I really see in the future, it's mostly going to be a refined 5-a-side or 7-a-side. So, look, what's that going to do for TV audience and the general competitions around the world? It's yet to be seen.
Does it scare you a little bit that the traditional game could get harmed?
Look, I think it's in everybody's mind, you know. It certainly, if it does get harmed, but I think, you know, we need to look at the future. I think 5-a-side, 7-a-side would be fast and exciting, and I think it'll still draw the crowds into it.
Well, Murray Grime, thanks for all the memories down on the pitch, and we wish you all the best in developing the umpires of the future.
Thanks, Ashley, and look forward to talking to you soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel Ricciardo, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, not a happy time for Daniel Ricciardo at the Australian Grand Prix, but a lot of pressure was put on him, and some would say maybe undue pressure. Did he falter under it? Well, we'll let you discuss that wherever you are.
I think the Australian Grand Prix has seen the black cattle walked underneath the same ladder that the Australian Open tennis tournament has, and that Australians really struggle.
Well, that was, though, before that we heard from Murray Grime. 4 Olympics, 2 World Cups, 6 Champions Trophies, a phenomenal career. And I do feel sorry for him, John, that when he was umpiring at a time when Australia was at its peak, so he rarely got to do the major finals because Australia was always playing in them. And that's, you feel sorry for an official when that's the case.
Simon Torfall comes to mind, the cricket umpire who, at a time when Australia was just belting everybody and winning everything, he couldn't umpire against them, or with them.
Yeah, and I think in a way that's very sad, because if you look, do they get the recognition, these officials, that they deserve? Because, you know, it's fair to say that Murray and Simon Torfall were probably two of the best in their sport at some point in their career, yet they've been deprived of those opportunities purely because the team that or the country they come from is also so strong.
Well, it would be fair to say that the idea of neutral umpires came about in cricket almost purely because of the reaction of other teams having to visit the subcontinent.
But I'll also say, because this is often forgotten in Australia, Australia were one of the ones who were against neutral umpires.
So they
actually were one of the last ones to come around and approve it.
Yeah, you know what? Whichever system you have in place, you're going to have people who whinge about it, especially when it comes to officiating and umpiring. And I think it's unfortunate for individuals that that is the situation it is, but I think for the sport, it helps protect it from unwarranted criticisms. You know, the last thing, it's one thing for an umpire to be incompetent, it's another thing for the perception of them to be cheating. And, you know, you don't want that.
I've got to be honest, I've not seen, in professional sport, I don't think I've ever seen one that I genuinely thought had cheated.
No, I can't say that. And let's face it,
I have in amateur sport.
Yeah, well, that's a different story. But umpiring is bloody hard. It is a hard gig. It is not as easy and as simple as it looks from sitting on your armchair. And we should always remember that when umpires make mistakes, as bad as they may be. Now, my turn. Well, rugby. Ashley, what's happening to rugby union and, by extension, rugby league in this country? And rugby union globally, it must be said. In the last couple of weeks, we've seen a secret meeting. Well, the meeting wasn't secret, but the outcome of the meeting for Sanzar was secret. And what's leaked out is essentially someone's going to have to go. The competition is too big, too unwieldy, and they're going to have to make some changes. Well, it was only last year they made the changes to make the competition more big and more unwieldy. So one has to question what the administrators here were thinking when they allowed the expansion to happen. And that goes back to the expansion of the Melbourne Rebels as well, and you could even argue to the Western Forces formation. Rugby is struggling horribly in this country, because they're not playing well, the money's not there, and the playing group is too dispersed. There's not enough concentration of good people in one team.
I think, John, rugby is struggling not just here. I mean, if you look at South Africa and you look at their teams in Super Rugby this year, they are putting out young players with next to no experience because they had over 75 players leave South Africa last at the end of the last Super Rugby season to go and play in Europe and Japan. Because, again, the money isn't there. You're earning in the rand. I mean, and the Australian dollar, for those of you who don't know, is 10 times what the rand is. So that puts it in perspective. So they're getting paid in rands, whereas they can go to Europe, earn euros, pounds, or they can go and earn yen, and they're earning so much more than they can earn in South Africa, and they can set themselves up for life. So that's one issue there. I agree with you, totally unwieldy to go to the size that it did. And now, I wrote a piece about it, that it was bizarre to me that Sanzar looked to expand, when if you looked at the start of the European competitions when rugby turned professional, they had two bigger and unwieldy leagues. And they changed it, they cut it back, because players were just drained when it came to international rugby. And if you look in those early years, when the game went professional in 96, a lot of the European teams were getting thumped by the Southern Hemisphere teams because the players were exhausted. They played just too much rugby. And I tried to get an interview with Michael Foley last year to discuss that when he was coach of the Force, but sadly, we could never sit down and discuss that. And I think that's a major thing. But when you also look, John, at the stats that came out last week, that the Crusaders, who are undoubtedly New Zealand's most successful franchise, their financial report last year, they only managed to break even. And then that meant that all the other New Zealand rugby franchises were operating financial losses. So you've got all the teams in Australia running at a financial loss. And the South African ones, I think, were in a pretty bad way as well. Now, it's a major, major problem. Whether they're going to go, and I've heard word that at that meeting, the ideal size for the competition was to be Super 12s, to go back to 12. Now you think, whoa, that's a big drop from where they are now. I think they will go back to 15, personally, that I don't think they can go as far back as 12. And I think what you'll see is there will be one team dropped from Australia, and you will have one dropped from South Africa, and they will either get rid of you might have the Sunwolves may play in the Australian franchise, or the Jaguars. There'll be six possibly in South Africa, with the Jaguars coming into their pool, and you'll play it that way. I don't know, it's very, very difficult, but as you say, the game is in a lot of trouble.
There's several issues going on here, and one of them is the expansion issue, as we've talked about just previously, and it goes across all sports as well, and especially when you're trying to run a club competition across national boundaries, where, as you say, South African players are getting paid in rand, Australian players are getting paid in Australian dollars, and I'm sure the New Zealand, I bet the South American players are being paid in pesos or whatever it is they happen to have as a currency, and the yen likewise. And when you start doing that, you get the playing field's not level. So, of course, those South Africans are going to run away and go and chase the money. And the money comes from broadcasters. Now, let's face it, the whole reason Sanzar has expanded the way it has is under the influence of broadcasters, because broadcasters want matches, and they convince administrators that they've got to give them more matches. Okay? The administrators go, great, we'll take the check. But they don't understand what impact that has on the players and the fans. Okay, I couldn't tell you how the Sanzar system works. I could not tell you how the Super Rugby tables and fixtures work, because it is so complicated. It drives fans away. The names of, I don't know who comes from where or what they mean or why they're there.
Well, you have hit the nail on the head that since they expanded it last year, it is now more complicated. My wife, who follows the rugby, she goes, I got no idea what's going on, who's playing who, when. Because again, now the fixturing's all changed. You used to know when games were, who was playing who, and that's become unwieldy. A bit like international cricket, where, you know, there used to be a format that you knew the games, who was playing who, what year, and then they've messed all that around now, and it doesn't follow a pattern that, you know, England were here last year, so that means the West Indies will be here the next year, followed by India and Pakistan the year after, and it's all changed. But look, I agree. I think it's just become so, so messy. there's a lot of talk about will a team survive in Perth. I personally think yes. I think Perth will. Whether it's the force, I actually don't think it may be the force. What I think you're going to see, though, and it goes back to the point you just made there, broadcasters. The thing that worked so well for the Western Force when they happened to start was you could have a game in New Zealand, you could then have a game in Sydney, you could then have a game in Perth, and then you could have a game in South Africa. So it suited the viewers. The time slots were perfect because they followed on from each other, and that worked really well. And I know working for television companies around the world, they want content. They just want content that is going to fill those channels. And they'll pay for ones that have a set program, that have good viewing figures, and then they'll pay peanuts for their other ones just to fill those other time slots. What I was interested to hear, or has been leaked, is that the Brumbies are in trouble because they don't get the crowds. Canberra's not the best place to go and have to play rugby. Will the Brumbies move to Perth? Don't know. Will the Sunwolves merge with the Force? Again, that's a possibility. Or will the Rebels and the Force merge? But I think you're going to see a merging of two teams. My gut is telling me you might see the Brumbies relocated to Perth. I don't know, but that's my gut feeling. I have no proof on that. I just have a gut feeling that that's what you're going to end up seeing.
And once again, this situation highlights the challenges that face Australian sport and Australian sport uniquely because of where we are geographically, our size, all those sorts of issues. Now, the decision by the FFA a few weeks ago not to expand the A-League, despite, you know, howls of protests from those people that wanted it to expand, in hindsight, looks like a really smart decision. Because expansion is not a good idea for leagues at this moment. Anywhere in the world, you have to be the NFL or the Premier League to start thinking about expansion.
I think the only thing with the FFA, John, where they've got to be very, very careful is the average football fan's getting bored with the A-League. And some of it is because they're playing each other three times in a season. There's no relegation, there's no promotion, which football fans are used to now. I know it's not necessarily a thing that happens in Australia, but if you follow football globally, you expect that and you enjoy that. And then the fact that we have it in state competitions, again, those people that are involved in the game want to see that. And I just think the FFA's got to be very, very careful because, and I got in an argument with someone from Fox Sports this weekend, because I think the A-League has plateaued. I thought it peaked probably fourth or fifth season, maybe sixth. Then it went down, and now I think it's just plateaued. I find it very difficult to watch. I still don't understand why teams where there is no relegation don't go out there and go, we're going to play attacking football. If they score one, we'll score two. Instead, we still see teams going out there for a draw, which to me has made the league so damn boring.
Pay that one, definitely. But, you know, it's Australian sport's got to stop comparing itself on a global level with the way those things work, because it does not work here. The geography of this country makes it impossible to work in the same way as those other leagues in other countries. I mean, there's things you can do in Germany with a league that you'll never be able to do in Australia because it will just cost you too much money and you'll go broke and the sport will die. And that's the real danger for expansion in Australia, is the money and the distance.
But you see, again, John, this is where I think, again, if we're going to pay these CEOs the big salaries, then they have to think outside of the box. They have to look at it and be a little bit more creative. So, for example, if you were going to have the A-League, why do we not see Perth Glory, who we all know travel the furthest? Why are all the games played on the weekend? What is to stop the Perth Glory, like they do in Europe, going over to Sydney, playing Sydney FC on a Saturday or a Friday night even, and then playing against Western Sydney Wanderers on a Wednesday? And then it saves money. They've only got one airfare there, one airfare back, instead of having to do that twice in a season. They could go to do the same in Melbourne. They could play Melbourne City and Melbourne Victory within a week in Melbourne. There is no reason why that... And to me, that should happen. And sensible stuff where you could save money, and there is no reason for player welfare, because in Europe, they play two games a week. Everybody knows that. You know, so it's not a player welfare issue as long as they get that rest day after the game.
Well, yeah, I mean, they do it in Europe, so there's no reason they can't do it here. And it's it's well documented why.
And the season here isn't as long as Europe.
Yeah, and there's well documented reasons why that's possible. And let's face it, an Olympic hockey tournament is how many games in 10 days or whatever it is. I mean, and they're played very high intense games, you know. So for sports such as that, there's absolutely no reason that those things can't be done and those fixturings shouldn't be made. I mean, to be fair, the A-League is in some way hampered in its fixturing by its involvement with Asian football in the clubs, you know, and that's a very thin line they've got to tread between the needs of our clubs and the needs of the Asian Champions League and how they work out the local league in conjunction with that. So that's a little bit of a thorn in what they do, but to have a team to have played another team twice before they've played a team once is just, I don't know how that works in a fixture. Or it does work in a fixture, not in a draw.
Yeah. Look, you raise some great points. I mean, there's no doubt that it is a very, very tricky situation in Australia. But again, I'd like to go back to the point I made earlier. If you're going to pay these CEOs millions of dollars, then they need to come up with solutions that are beneficial to the sport as a whole, make it attractive to the punter, and at the same time are economical or make more economic sense is probably the better way to put it.
Just back to the Super Rugby for a second. South Africa had the Currie Cup. Before Super 12s came
they still
on,
do have
Super
the
8s,
Cup.
I think it started out, didn't it?
Tens.
Tens. They had a really strong nationwide domestic league. Okay, New Zealand had a really strong nationwide domestic league. Australia never had that and has never had that. So they were coming from a far poorer place, so to speak, in trying to get people engaged with the game of rugby because there hadn't been previously this framework that people could attach themselves to. So when we try and introduce things that aren't actually... people find it difficult to tangibly understand what those concepts are or what those ideals are being expressed.
But can I raise something on that? Because to me, you then also have to go back and look at the ARU and the people that were running the Australian Rugby Union in those early 90s, late 90s, because they were so Sydney and Queensland centric that they did little, in fact next to nothing,
absolutely,
to expand the game in other parts of Australia. It was all about Sydney, all about Queensland, and of course Canberra. And they're paying the price for that now. And I feel sorry for the CEOs at the moment because they are the ones who are carrying the can for the failure of your John O'Neills who were actually at the helm back then. And I think you must always remember that he had the opportunity to do that, but did he do it? I mean, okay, to be fair, he did launch, the Australian Rugby Championship, which then got canned after a year.
Which was the worst thing they ever did.
Yeah, they should never have canned that.
No.
Now they've got the NRC and that's got some traction. But to be fair to John O'Neill, he did launch that and try to do it, but I think that was probably, again, it was a little bit too late, needed to have happened a lot earlier.
Yeah, and... You also go back to the officials from Queensland and New South Wales. I mean, when the Force started, Queensland officials whinged and moaned like stuck pigs about players coming to play for the Western Force. Where did you think the Western Force was going to get players from? What did they think was going to happen when the Western Force came in? Did they think that suddenly mushrooms were going to grow with rugby players on them in the West? No, of course they were going to have to give up something. But they were so concerned about their own selves that they failed in helping Australian rugby grow. All they were concerned about was me, Queensland, me, or me, New South Wales, and they didn't see the greater vision that rugby needed to pursue.
Now, it's certainly going to be very interesting times for Super Rugby, but it will be cold. I think there's no doubt about that in 2018. Well, that's probably enough from us for this week, but we will be back with a really interesting interview on the next show. We do recommend you to tune into that one. That's all we're going to say now.
See you, Ash.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next.